Leah Thomas was a recruiting intern at Confluent who decided she liked computer science better, changed majors, got a second internship, and delivered KIP 450 this past summer. That's a Streams KIP adding some new windowing functionality. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I talked to her today about the interning process, learning a big new code base, and of course, sliding windows in Streams. We've had some audio problems on a couple of episodes recently, and this is one of them, so please bear with us on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am, as always, your host, Tim Berglund, and I'm joined in the virtual studio by my once and future colleague, software engineer Leah Thomas. Leah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
You bet. Now, I say once and future because you have been an intern here at Confluent twice, and you're going to be a full-time employee soon. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I feel like I've gone around the block in all the different roles, so I'm excited to start the full time.
Yeah, very happy about that. So, in fact, by the time this airs, you will be a fait accompli. So,
yes,
that is fantastic news, and I'm glad to hear it. Anyway, I wanted to talk to you today about the interning process. And you've got firsthand experience in two very different roles, and so that's what I'd like to make this about. What interning is like, and in particular, I think you have something very unique to offer to people who want to get involved in Kafka as contributors, which is, over the past few months, you've had a front row seat to the process of getting to know the Kafka code base, or at least a part of it. And so I kind of want to talk about what that's been like, how you've done it, and maybe give some tips on how people can do that. There's a lot of people who are just users and don't want to make modifications, but for people who do, you're a newly minted expert in how to do that.
Yeah, I definitely feel like, you know, jumping straight into the addition process was really cool, and getting to see how you can, you know, change Kafka to be what you want it to be and really make improvements from either inside of Confluent or outside of Confluent. Whatever ideas you have, you know, you can work with other people in the community and really make it happen, which was really cool to see.
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess you did it as a Confluent intern, but people can do this. When it comes to Apache Kafka, you don't even have to know what Confluent is.
Exactly.
To be a contributor. So, of course, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably sort of know. Anyway, tell us about you're a recent graduate. Tell us about your degree program, your major, and after that, we can get into
it. Sure. I just graduated May 2020 from Georgetown University with a dual degree in computer science and women's and gender studies. And you kind of previewed this before, but I interned last summer of 2019, with Confluent as well, but I was actually the recruiting intern. So I had a computer science minor at that point and a gender studies major, and was thinking that I wanted to go into tech, but not necessarily a super technical role. So I did the recruiting internship and really liked it and liked the recruiting team. But I was friends with a bunch of the engineering interns, and I saw what they were working on. And I was like, you know, I think that that's what I want to do instead. I think I want to be solving the technical problems and having the technical solutions that I love working with people, but the working with people in a recruiting aspect was a lot harder than I thought it would be. And it wasn't quite what I wanted my future career to be. So I came back this summer as a software engineering intern, switched to the Streams team. So my last year of school, I added a computer science major. I switched my minor to a major and have the dual degree now. And then did the Streams internship, and now I'm coming back full time starting next week on Kafka Streams. So I'm really excited.
That's awesome. And I suppose I should say we are recording this on Thursday, September 24th. So the following Monday, 8th, Monday the 28th.
Yeah.
Is a happy day. That's just fantastic news. So
yes, thank you.
And that transition from recruiting to the Streams team is really interesting. And I guess you said that recruiting was in one sense harder than you expected, and also didn't really feel like the thing that, you know, you didn't sense a calling to do it.
Yeah. I always thought that I was a huge people person, but then I found when I was having to talk to people about jobs all day long, I didn't want to talk to people anymore. So I guess I'm not quite the people person that I thought I was. But I think that, I mean, I think it was cool to see the recruiting side for sure. Learned a lot of valuable things about that end of the process that I think has helped me and will continue to help me. And also made really great connections at Confluent. I feel like I was, because I did technical recruiting last summer, I was able to meet engineers and already know engineers to some degree when I started my software engineering internship this summer. So definitely a less traditional path, but I'm pretty happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, there's so much that you said in there that I think is really important. And I do want to talk about Kafka code soon, but just indulge me. Number one, yeah, recruiting is really hard. And The whole, I thought I was a people person, turns out not. I thought early in my career that I wasn't a people person. And that I wanted to be a developer because, you know, computers were easy to deal with and people were hard. I think I was right about that. I think people are harder than you know, any sort of computing device. But I kind of found out later that I was more of a people person. And, you know, eventually my career took the trajectory it does, where it's this combination of the two.
Yeah.
But the process you went through, I just recently read a book called Range, subtitled Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World by David Epstein. Really good book. And the basic idea was early in life, and that's defined in different ways depending on what you're talking about, but, you know, kind of high school, college, early career type years, he's making the argument that it's good to go through what he calls a sampling period of trying some different things. And so this process you just described is this 100% Epstein compatible. I think I want to do this. Let me try this. Because you don't know, right?
Yeah, you have no idea, you know?
Yeah. And so you try it. And you're like, no, that wasn't actually quite it. I can do it, but it doesn't feel good. Let me try this other thing. And because it, you know, I know when everybody listening heard, well, I did a recruiting internship and then I joined the streams team, right? Like, well, okay, those are different. But that's exactly the point, is that since you don't, it's really difficult to create knowledge about, well, frankly, who you are and what you're good at and where you can make the greatest contribution. And these processes, like, you know, I didn't think I was a people person, but I was, or I thought I wasn't, but, you know, whatever. You just have to try stuff. And I think it's really cool that you did that and even changed your major, or, well, added a major, to be clear.
Yeah, I definitely think that I was lucky that I had the opportunity to try something out and then, like, make that switch. And I was able to, I think a lot of people do this with boot camps now if they're switching into coding, which I think is a great opportunity for people. And I think that it's cool that people can pivot, you know, at different parts of their career. But I think I was lucky that I had the space in my schedule to change a minor to a major and make it work while I was still in school and really, like, leverage my degree to give me that, like you said, that path. Like, I really like engineering now, but like you said, you know, career trajectories change. And so I think that, like, the background that I have will set me up for whatever I want to do 20 years down the road.
Very true. Very true. Also, just want to note, Georgetown grad endorses boot camps. That, I like that part. That just happened.
Yes, for whatever credibility I have to do that, for sure.
That's funny. I was just yesterday at a COVID era wedding, a very small wedding, and everything done, you know, I was running a live streaming is why I was there.
Okay, nice.
And there was conversation among a bunch of young people, you know, is college a good idea? Is college a bad idea? And one of a recent college grad, who actually happens to be my daughter, was making the, no, you don't have to go to college argument. I'm like, wait a second, you just went to college. But,
you know,
the boot camp approach is super cool. Whole different subject, but I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is usually a non-traditional, you know, often second career or no college right out of high school kind of pathway. And that's great that those things exist and have credibility now. And I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Now, you in your internship this summer, oh, by the way, last summer, did you help people get hired? I feel like we should know that.
I mean, I think I did, but I didn't have a candidate. I didn't put a candidate all the way through the process, which I was also like, well, that's kind of sad. but I did like a rotational program last summer. So I did like sourcing for a little bit, and then I did like technical sourcing, and then I did university recruiting, and then I did scheduling. I was coordinator.
Coordinator.
So I think that while I didn't have my own candidate go all the way through, I think I helped with the candidate experience. That's what I'll say.
That is so important because even for people who don't get hired or who aren't interested or whatever, job hunting's a big deal. You want it to be as unstressful as possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And coordinator, oh boy, I feel so guilty every time I work with a coordinator. I'm like, yeah, I have to change that again. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But
that's how it goes.
You know this band firsthand.
I do.
But
I do.
Let's talk about your work on streams.
Yeah.
You did a KIP, which is not, I mean, that's huge. First of all, in case there's anybody who doesn't know, tell them what a KIP is and then tell them what your KIP was.
Sure. So a KIP is a Kafka Improvement Proposal. It's the process where somebody can make changes to like the Kafka open source code. And it mostly focuses on the public API changes. So anything that changes the way users interact with Kafka, and in our case, Kafka Streams, has to go through the KIP process to make sure people in the Kafka community like accept it, and that the community as a whole agrees that this is the right decision to make. So people aren't just like deprecating random methods and making all these additions without people knowing what's going on.
Good. It's got to be debated openly. Yes. There's a wiki page that kicks off the KIP and sort of a template, and then mailing list discussion.
Yeah.
That's all in the open.
Yeah. You have the, and then once a mailing discussion dies down, you open a vote, and it has to be open for a minimum, I think, 72 hours. And you have to have at least 3 Kafka contributors give it approval. And then there's like a different amount for if people say they don't want you to do it. But I've heard that that doesn't happen too often.
Creating a KIP that you need that much. Okay.
Well, no, that's for getting your KIP approved, that you need 3 Kafka committers to say that they are on board.
Got it.
So my KIP was KIP 450, which was implementing sliding windows in Kafka Streams. So sliding windows are a different form of windowed aggregations for the data that comes through Kafka Streams. Right now we have time-based windows and sliding windows. Time-based windows and session windows. And I just implemented sliding windows, which is almost a conglomeration of the two of them, the two existing windows. And so I worked on obviously the KIP and the KIP discussion, which was pretty lengthy for this one because it is a new feature that ended up being a little more complicated than I initially thought it would be because of, you know, storing all of the data we need to store and then outputting to the user different data as well as the data gets processed through the Kafka stream. And then, so the KIP discussion lasted a while, but we hammered out a lot of the implementation details during that, which was super helpful for me. And I'm really grateful to my team for being really involved in the KIP discussion as well. And then after that, it was implementing it and then doing the whole testing suite. So adding all of the unit and integration tests. And then also I ended up adding it to the benchmark and soak tests for Confluent internally.
Oh, nice. I didn't know that last part. That's super cool. So that refers to, to separate the two, this KIP is an Apache Kafka KIP, all part of the open source code, all done through the open KIP process. And the feature is an AK feature, but also we do benchmarking and our own soak tests internally, since we use Kafka in our on-prem product and in cloud and stuff. So we beat on it in ways that are just ours.
Yes, exactly.
So let's, if you don't mind, I want to talk about windowing a little bit. This
sure.
was, you said sliding.
Yes.
What was the KIP number?
450. And it should be coming out in 2.7.
Okay, good. And yeah, I am aware of rumblings of discussion of timing of 2.7. How's that for being non-committal? I didn't say anything just there, but we're kind of thinking about when to release that. And I don't know, that's a PMC decision when that gets made by we, yeah. I mean them. I guess I'm always looped in on that stuff because there's usually a video of me standing in front of a river or in some city somewhere in the world talking about it. So I'll have to know. But good. I can pretty much guarantee you KIB 450 will be in that video because this is a major change to streams.
Wow. Well, that's so exciting for me. That's kind of a fun plug.
There you go. I can't see how it would not be there. And if whoever organizes that list tries to not put it there, I will tell them to put it there. So
thanks.
Tell us about windowing. And I want to say hopping windows and sliding windows are the two closest, but I might be wrong. Yeah. And tell me if I am. But
no, you're right.
Okay, good.
So
tell us what hopping windows are.
So hopping windows are a fixed time window. So over your Kafka stream, you can set a certain amount of time, say 10 minutes, and your data will be processed within that 10 minutes. And with a hopping window, the size is always fixed, and then you set some advance. So you can have a 10-minute window that advances by 2 minutes. So say you have a window from 9 a.m. to 9:10, then the next window would be at 9:02 to 9:12, et cetera. So it kind of hops 2 minutes along based on the advance time. And these windows are like basically preset, so you can figure out where the windows are going to fall based on the size of the window and the advance of the window. So no matter where the data comes in, your windows will always be at like set timestamps because the way the windows are calculated of where they fall is based on the advance and the size. So you can approximate a sliding window by using hopping windows with an advance of 1 millisecond. So that's like you're creating a window essentially for every possible millisecond in time, which creates a ton of windows. And
sounds like the definition of does not scale.
Yes. It ends up being really inefficient and just not like hopping windows just aren't very elastic. And so sliding windows is a way to essentially get every combination of the data in your stream that fits within a certain window size by using a sliding window. So sliding windows aren't fixed in time. So like I said, with hopping windows, you can predict where they're going to fall on the time axis. You can't do that with a sliding window. A sliding window exists along the time axis based on where the data comes in. So if you have data coming in at like 9:05 and 9:30, the windows you're going to get are different if you have data coming in at 9:02 and 9:40.
So the width of the window is not fixed?
Well, the width of the window is fixed. The start and the end point of the window are not fixed. Those are dependent on the data.
Got it.
Yeah. And so you can set the window.
That matters when you, if you have data that's bursty, because that example you just gave was bursty, where there was something at 9:03 and then 9:30, like it's quiet for a while.
Yeah.
So that's an important factor, right? Am I right? That's a question. Is that an important factor?
Yeah, I think it is, because if you think about the hopping window approximation of sliding windows in that example where you have the bursty data, you're creating a bunch of windows in between. Whereas with sliding windows, you only create windows when you need them. And so you're only creating the windows that specifically are necessary for those two data points coming in.
Got it.
So the sliding windows are defined not necessarily by size, but they're defined by time difference, which is the maximum amount of time between two data records for them to fall within the same window, which we use that phrasing because there was some discussion about inclusivity and exclusivity for the window bounds. And so to try to get rid of any confusion, we use time difference instead of size, since it isn't strictly size. It's more about how close the records are.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. It's, It's a little bit in the weeds, but they are, every sliding window will essentially be the same size. You will just have fewer windows if you have fewer data, and you will have more windows if you have more data. So it is a lot more efficient. It ends up being more efficient, and you only store the windows that you need and only create the windows that you need. So if you're looking for that kind of aggregation, sliding windows is a lot better way to go than trying to make it work with the current hopping windows implementation.
And what's the cost of those extra windows? Why not have them laying around? Where, what data structures are being allocated when you create all those, when you would have created all of them with hopping windows?
Yeah. So if you create a bunch of overlapping windows, you have to store them in the window store. And then with hopping windows, if they have data inside of them, they're going to be output to the user. So in theory, if you have a bunch of windows that are overlapping, it means that they're probably, there's going to be some set of them that have the same data inside. So it's essentially like a repeat window with different start and end times, but everything inside is the same. And the user is, so those are all being stored in the window store, and then also all being emitted as partial results to the user. So I think it just ends up clogging up, ends up using more space in the window store, and then also ends up clogging up what the user really wants, because you're getting a bunch of information that you probably don't really need.
Right. There's whatever topic is holding the output of that window. And I guess it's possible in the topology that extra things are happening to that before it actually gets persisted. But you're still at some point emitting things that might be a lot of noise and not really interesting, because you had to set this pathologically short advanced time.
Yeah, exactly. And sliding windows are, because they're essentially defined backwards in time, you're able to, if you as a user want to query the window store and you want to find everything that happened at, like, you know that something came through at 9:10 and you want to know what happened, you can find the window that ends at 9:10 and see everything that happened in that window. So you can like query essentially back in time and see what has been going on.
Got it. And you mentioned the Windows Store. Tell us about that a little bit, because that's what came to mind when you said hopping window with 1 millisecond advance time. I was like, oh crap, that is going to be a problem now.
Yeah.
What's the window store and what's it there for?
Yeah. So there's different types of window stores. And the one that we, I think, use, maybe don't quote me on this, but we use the RocksDB store pretty frequently. And it's just a way to essentially, to store your data, obviously. And then you're able to query it as a user, but also get access to it within the Kafka Streams program. So while sliding windows are processing, we query the window store ourselves in the sliding windows algorithm and see what has already been created and stored in there. And then we also add to it. And then the user can also, from outside of the Streams application, well, I guess inside of the Streams application, but outside of the sliding windows algorithm, they can also query the window store and get access to everything that's been created and stored in there.
So there's an API to get those old windows that are there lying around.
Yeah, there's an API to access the old windows. It's essentially like a bunch of different fetch methods. And I think they're all, for the most part, like serialized as bytes, but depending on the type of window store, you store different things. So the window store stores a windowed object, and then also a little bit of other information, and then other types of stores obviously would store, they don't need to store a windowed object, so they store just more generic items as well.
Right. And I guess those are there in case messages... I've recently been trained by Matthias on these words. Matthias Sachs, who's a Streams committer. I was going to say messages might come in late, but that's the wrong word, Tim. Messages might come in out of order.
Yes.
So if the message timestamp indicates that the actual event time put the message in a previous window, and you know it's just out of order in the topic, which is totally possible, right? You have that, then you need to go basically fetch that old window and say, oh, wait, we need to update the aggregations in it.
Yes, exactly. Those out of order records definitely make calculating the windows more complicated. But by having the Windows Store, we're able to see everything that was created previous. We just need to know which one to pick. And then we're able to update the windows with like you said, the out of order data.
This is one of the reasons why the vast majority of people want an API that does this, and they want people like Leah to solve these problems, because that stuff and the edge cases in there get unpleasant quickly. And
yeah,
you want that solved one time and not lots and lots of times in one API.
Exactly.
Cool. Okay. So that is KIP 450. And thanks for that explanation. It's this is one of those things. You made it make sense, which is not easy, because it's, Windows are one of those things that they like diagrams.
They do. They really need diagrams.
And I think when it comes to sliding windows, I'm feeling like that's going to be an animation. Whenever there's a video that gets made about those, I don't think that's going to be a still picture. You kind of need a thing that moves to really make that land. But I'm happy to confess, I haven't kept up with the KIP, and I knew that it was happening, and we talked about it a little bit before, but I don't have a super crisp understanding of it. And you helped me clarify that there. So thank you.
Good. Well, I'm glad it was at least semi-helpful, but you're right. The visualizations definitely help with the windowing.
Yes. How about just the process of jumping into the code base? Obviously you're familiar with at least this part of the Streams code base now. And there's a lot more. So whatever the scope is, what was that like to sit down with it, and how did you start learning it? Tell us about that.
It was definitely overwhelming because the code base is huge. And at first I was like, I don't even know how to like find, there's so many files in here. Like, how do I even find the class that I want? Like, where are they? And so getting some like basic IntelliJ checks was really helpful, and understanding like the search function and how to like connect all the classes together with the IntelliJ shortcuts was like really helpful. And I definitely needed that right off the bat to be able to like explore how everything was connected and how the existing types of windowing worked. So definitely spending some time looking through the code and seeing what all the different parts were and trying to do a deep dive was where I started, which I thought was pretty helpful. But I feel like the later stage of actually creating the testing was where I was able to understand more of how like Kafka interacts with Streams. Because when I was doing the sliding windows, it was pretty just Streams focused. Like obviously there was some Kafka components mixed in, but I felt like I was pretty separated from the core ideas of Kafka. So after I was creating the testing, I used like the live debugging feature on IntelliJ. I'm not sponsored by IntelliJ, but I do really like it. And really like jump through the code and see what was being created when and how it was being created and who was creating it. And see how like how Kafka Streams worked with core Kafka, like live, you know, on the ground as it was all happening, and seeing that come together, I feel like was the, like, I guess like the cherry on top for starting to understand how Kafka works as a code base.
Right. And if I may ask, how would you rate your familiarity with core Kafka?
Ooh.
And I know not code base, because you were new to the whole code base when you came into the internship, but
yeah.
What did you know about Kafka when you started this, when you're jumping in cold to this big giant thing?
Oh, man. I mean, from the recruiting pitch, I knew that it was data streaming.
Nice.
And so I would rate like maybe like a 3. I tried to read the book before I started a little bit, so I had some idea of producers and consumers and topics. But in terms of how the code worked, not very high understanding, like pretty low.
That's awesome though. I mean, if you think about it, and you know, you just did it, so maybe you don't see it this way, but looking at what you did, you're jumping really into the Streams code base, and that's a part of Kafka. It's this client library. It's outside of the core thing, but if it's, you know there are producers and consumers and messages, and that's kind of your That's kind of your abstraction that you have for Kafka. That's a pretty high level abstraction. We can agree.
Yeah.
There's still just a lot more to learn there. That was, and that's just impressive that you, you jumped into streams and made that contribution and learned Kafka internals at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I definitely have a lot to learn still. I think there's just, I think that familiarity, you know, like spending time with it just really, increases knowledge, obviously. So I think that, you know, the next couple of months as I continue to work on it, I think that my knowledge will probably grow exponentially, which I'm pretty excited about to like understand more fully how both sides of Kafka work.
Absolutely. Now, so you mentioned IntelliJ, which I would say, obviously, it's Java code base. You're going to have some IntelliJ
yes.
there. And it's kind of, it was a Twitter conversation last week about this. There is, I think, a little bit of Java work being done in Visual Studio Code. It's like you can, mm-hmm. but pretty much everybody does it in IntelliJ. And so you did that and you used that. Some people showed you ways of exploring a code base and finding, you know, maybe implementations of an interface or where to locate a class and just basic stuff like that to navigate.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was super helpful.
Yeah. Those are
obviously,
those are good things. And as you know, just as I think guidance for new developers, don't underestimate both the cost and the value of learning an IDE well.
Yeah.
It's a big investment. There's a lot of stuff to know. And when you're new and everything is new and confusing and you feel like you don't know anything and there's all that, you know, you may not be aware of the IDE learning that's happening, but it's huge. And, you know, if you ever pick up a new IDE in your career, like say you get started with IntelliJ, then the next one you learn, you're like, oh crap, all the mental model is different. Every keyboard shortcut is different. Everything. Why is this so complicated?
Yep, exactly.
Because you just slowly learned the first one, but it's a huge investment and it's hugely useful.
But yeah, just that.
Was your, as you're learning the code, what combination of it, or what part of that experience was, we'll call static analysis, you know, just reading the code, and what part was at runtime? Did you ever like run a test and set a breakpoint, step through things?
Yeah.
What'd you do?
I spent a lot of time running tests and setting breakpoints and stepping through things. The algorithm itself, we hashed out a lot in the Kit process. And so when that was implemented, I didn't find too many bugs when I was running the tests. But there were some things that I just felt like I didn't understand and some results I was getting that were weird. And so I did step through a lot and just like so many breakpoints and so much data. And I think there were times that I didn't utilize the IDE where I could have, you know, created a smaller data set and made it a lot less work when I was stepping through, but I ended up just kind of taking the long route, which I don't think I would do in the future. But it felt easier at the time to not have to change anything. But definitely a lot of stepping through, because I found that, you know, in the static code, there's a fair number of abstractions, right? And so things are connected somewhat differently at runtime because there's actual like values coming in. And there's like things have been created. And so stepping through at runtime was really helpful. And it took me to parts of the code base that I hadn't been to when I was just doing the static coding. So like the further dive into how Streams was communicating with Kafka and what all the things that were happening in the middle and like any of the deserializer issues that I didn't know about when I was doing the static coding all came out at runtime, which was like actually really cool to see. And I love the IntelliJ runtime debugger. It's pretty helpful. And I felt like it was, yeah, really cool to see the windows being processed like step by step by step and see them working the way that they worked in my head. And like it actually all coming together, which was like very validating and very gratifying as well.
Yes. And, it's kind of funny because even with Java as a not dynamic language, you know, it's like you have, at least not typically in Java code, where you've got new kinds of classes being created and you know, missing method handlers, trapping surprise method calls from strings that are t- taken as input from the outside world.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that stepping through is super important, even with Java not being a particularly dynamic language, right? It's weird in a Java project for somebody to use like some bytecode manipulation library to create new methods at runtime. It's weird. I guess Spring does it all over the place. But it's not everyday code in Java the way it would be. Like I'm thinking of Groovy, where you have explicit mechanisms where you can call a method on an object, and if the method doesn't exist, there's a handler that you can go make up a method, you know, stuff like that. That, you know, good luck with static analysis. That's hard to understand what the code is doing without stepping through it. Even so, in Java, though, in a non-trivial project like Kafka, there's, you know, an abstract class, and you think you know which one is actually instantiated at runtime, and you're wrong until you step in. You know, you just don't know. You gotta look.
Yeah.
So
and it's hard to look for what you don't know exists too. You know, like I can't search for something if I don't know what I'm searching for. So that runtime was really helpful for me being less familiar with what will happen at runtime.
Exactly. And even when you start to get there, you're like, okay, here's the package with the implementations of that interface. And so it's one of these. And you can't still quite, and then you step through it and like, oh no, okay, there was another package with other implementations. Okay. That's why you just kind of have to look at what it's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing occurred to me. You said you did it the hard way. You took the long way around, and you're not going to do that in the future. And I thought this would be a time for the narrator to say she would, in fact, take the long way around in the future.
It's probably still true.
It's true. It's true. I mean, you're going to be super good at Kafka and Kafka Streams, and you're going to know that code base better than everybody but 100 people in the world. The next non-trivial project you jump into, you'll be wiser. But of course, I think the one thing that I wouldn't say just to you, but to anybody who is new as a developer or jumping into, you know, a significant project that you didn't write for the first time. And this is, I've talked to Gwen recently about joining Kafka now versus joining Kafka 8 years ago. It's a little harder now, you know, Leah's job versus a 8 year older version of Leah. This Leah has it a little worse because it's just a much, much more complex project. It's a much more mature project.
Yeah. There's a lot.
It's good.
A lot there's more a lot. There. Yeah.
But it feels the same way every time. At least as I remember from when I tried to read code of large projects early in my career versus later in my career, that same feeling of lostness and I don't know anything and probably not good enough to do this job, you know, all those kinds of feelings you have when you're just completely lost reading a big piece of new code. I don't think they ever stop. And maybe there are people, you know, and tweet me if this is the case, if you're like, I never felt like that. I think that's psychologically interesting if you never did. But
I'm sure there's somebody out there who doesn't feel like that at all, or won't admit to it at least.
That's fine if you won't admit to it. I totally get that. Like, you don't have to tweet that stuff or talk about it on a podcast if you don't want to. But yeah, there's confidence, and then there's, I don't know, clinical terms for when you don't doubt yourself, and maybe you should a little bit. But that feeling is not one that goes away.
Yeah, I definitely think, I think that is, I feel like something that's, for me coming in from like a little bit of a less traditional path, and I feel like, you know, having my first software engineering internship after most of my peers have had multiple software engineering internships, people like talking about that feeling was really helpful for me, and for people to be open about like, the first few months I was super confused. There's so much going on. Like, I didn't really know. It took me a while to ramp up and understand, and being like open and transparent about how long it takes to be comfortable in something, I feel like is really helpful in like, it was helpful for me to gauge where I'm at and where I should be at, to kind of like check myself against the goals and expectations I have, to not be setting them, you know, horribly high, but also holding myself to a high standard that there are parts of this code base that I want to understand, but also, you know, I was there for 12 weeks. I can't understand everything. So talking to people about the idea of jumping into something with the complete unknown and then looking at something new, even after you've been working on a part of Kafka for so long and being like, yeah, I don't know what that is, was helpful in me feeling a lot more comfortable about where I'm at.
Such a good point, because you have the turning the minor into the major thing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you had this other career path and you're like, no, I don't want that. I want this. And you did it. You made the decision. You did it, which is all amazing. Thanks. But that's important to call out, again, for people who are on the junior end of their career. Or even not. Now there's this story you can tell yourself about, oh, this is probably harder for me because I wasn't doing this 2 years ago. You know, if I just started as a computer science major my freshman year, this would all be easy. And it's not. There's nothing easy about jumping into a code base like Streams, and it never feels different. It's always great. I mean, you get into it and you master it and you have all those feelings of success, learning how to work with it and actually build things in it. But no, the first time you look at code like that, it's almost as bad as days when you write time zone code or just in general date and time code. Those are still just like, you think that maybe this is the wrong career choice for me. And you need sort of some self-care after you do that. It's fine. Again, everybody, it's like that for everybody. It's just terrible code. Okay, so we're almost at time, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk about Soak and performance testing. And I don't know how much you got into it, but just from your perspective, what happens there? It's a cool thing.
Yeah.
Fun to talk about.
Let's see, which was shorter? I think Soak was shorter. Cause Soak, you really just are creating like kind of a huge, Streams application that's running for as long as we can make it run. And so for that, all I did was like add a really basic sliding window aggregation to the topology. And then it's like in there with everything else. And now when we run it to make sure that everything is working smoothly and run it for long periods of time to make sure it can last, sliding windows are also being tested. So I haven't heard. I don't know if it's broken with sliding windows yet. I don't think it has. But it's a little flag system. If there's anything wrong in what I wrote with sliding windows, hopefully we would find it in Soak. And then, you know, as we create more things with Streams, if anything of that we add breaks sliding windows, in theory, like Soak would help us identify some of those issues. And then the benchmark test, I actually want to expand some. So maybe I'll work on that sometime later this year. But it's about making sure that Streams is working, like the throughput is as high as we want it to be, and that it's not, the Streams application isn't slowed down by running sliding windows, that it isn't, something's not getting clogged up or the throughput's low or we're losing threads or anything like that when we're doing the sliding window aggregation. So it's another benchmark test. The other ones you can do other types of windowing and benchmark tests. I think you can do suppression and benchmark tests. But what I'd really like to do is, there's essentially two implementations of sliding windows, one that uses a forward iterator for the window store and one that uses a reverse iterator through the window store. And the reverse iterator is like essentially the default implementation. And I think that it's more efficient. But what I'd really like to do is be able to test it on the benchmark test and see what the most efficient way to run sliding windows is to potentially tweak the implementation.
Awesome. Yeah, it's important to check and see which one actually runs faster. But it's nice that infrastructure is in place. And the Soak test sounds especially cool. So that's like a giant topology that's got joins and groups and reduces and processor things and just whatever. And you just hit it with data for a long time.
Exactly.
Love it.
Yeah. And you just see, you know, you hope that everything works well for a long period of time.
Yep. And if it doesn't, you fix it.
Exactly.
Hey, Lee, I think this has been really helpful for not just people who are new as developers and new at Kafka, but people who want to use streams and want to understand windowing better. So this has been great. My guest today has been Leah Thomas. Leah, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed talking to you too, Tim. And thanks for having me.
Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? Some free Confluent Cloud. Use the promo code 60PDCAST, that's 60PDCAST, to get an additional $60 of free Confluent Cloud usage. Be sure to activate it by December 31st, 2021, and use it within 90 days after activation. And any unused promo value on the expiration date will be forfeit, and there are a limited number of codes available, so don't miss out. Anyway, as always, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in our community Slack. There's a Slack signup link in the show notes if you'd like to join. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover us, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.